Imagine trying to build, say, a treehouse without knowing how long the wood pieces are, or planning a trip without knowing how far you need to travel or maybe how fast you're going. How do we even begin to quantify the world around us? You know, describe how big things are, how far they move, or, well, how quickly they get there. Today, we're doing a deep dive into exactly that. These really fundamental concepts of measurement, specifically length, and the unseen dynamics of motion. We're basically pulling out the most vital bits from your source materials on these core ideas. Think of it as your shortcut to getting really well informed.
Yeah, and what's fascinating here is how these principles let us unlock and quantify just about everything from like a tiny ant all the way up to the giant rockets we send into space. Our AI research assistant, EB, kind of flags this in its analysis. EB is sort of our guide today, making sure this journey into these concepts is, you know, deep but still really accessible.
Okay, sounds good. Let's unpack this then. Our mission for this deep dive is pretty clear. Explore why measuring length is so important. Understand how standard units came about and why we need them. Grasp the different ways objects move. And start looking at how we analyze that movement using time and distance. So, measurement first. It seems obvious, maybe. Mm-hmm. But why is quantifying length so crucial? Not just day to day, but for science itself. We see it everywhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like a tailor needs exact fabric measurements for clothes to fit.
Right. Or a carpenter, they need precise dimensions so the furniture actually works and is stable.
Exactly.
And you put on something important. These everyday examples seem simple, but looking back, the history is kind of messy. Our sources mention this fact flash about early methods, what we call non-standard units.
Mm-hmm.
Things like, you know, hand spans, footsteps, arms lengths. Can you imagine the confusion?
Oh, totally. Inconsistent.
Very. The foot, for example, the sources say it varied wildly. Sometimes it was literally based on the king's actual foot. That inconsistency meant, well, replicating scientific experiments was tough, and trade, forget about it, beyond your local area.
That makes complete sense. So the move to standard units, it wasn't just for neatness. It was a real need for consistency everywhere. And that's where the metric system steps in, right? The meter is the base unit in the SI, the International System of Units, but we also use centimeters, millimeters, kilometers, all related. It's actually amazing how precise we can be now with lasers and atomic clocks and stuff.
It really is. And the key features of these standard units, they're universally accepted, they're consistent, accurate, reliable. Compare that to those old non-standard units, precision was, well, subjective at best, low accuracy. A meter is a meter, Tokyo, Toronto, doesn't matter. That ensures incredible precision, reliability across the globe. This wasn't just convenient, it was like a cornerstone for the scientific revolution. It meant data could actually be checked by anyone, anywhere.
Right. And getting practical, the tools we use kind of depend on the job. For smaller, straight things, like a notebook, you've got the centimeter scale. Often 15 or 30 centimeters long, simple.
Yep. Then there's the meter rod, usually a full meter, 100 centimeters, good for maybe classroom stuff or measuring furniture.
But what about tricky shapes, like a curved pipe or a round table? That's where the measuring tape comes in. It's flexible.
Exactly. Made of cloth, plastic, metal sometimes. They come in all sorts of lengths, even up to 50 meters. No. Crucial for tailors, engineers, architects, anyone dealing with curves or long distances.
Okay. But using these tools right, it's not just about slapping it down next to the object, is it?
Hmm.
There's a correct way to measure length. It's all about precision. First, the scale has to be flat, parallel to the object. Makes sense. Second, zero alignment. Huh? You got to line up the zero mark, not necessarily the edge of the ruler with one end.
That's a really important point about the zero mark.
And third, critically, your eye position. You have to look straight down exactly above the reading point. Otherwise, you get that parallax error. Right? Your measurement is off just because of the angle you're looking from.
Precisely. Those simple steps, they're the foundation of getting it right.
Mm-hmm.
Like the example in the source, if something starts at the 1 centimeter mark and ends at the 6 centimeter mark, its length is 5 centimeters. Simple subtraction. But that only works if your alignment and eye position are spot on.
And you mentioned the zero mark.
Hmm.
That touches on a common misconception, doesn't it? You might think all rulers start measuring right from the very end.
But they often don't. Many have a small gap before the zero. It's deliberate for accuracy, especially when measuring from a true edge. So lining up with that zero mark is key. And related to standards, even though we still talk about feet and inches in some places, the modern inch isn't some random length anymore. It's actually defined by the metric system. It's exactly 25.4 millimeters.
Wow. Okay, so it all ties back together. Global standards rule, basically.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
It underscores how interconnected it all is now.
Okay, one more thing on length before we move on. describing positions, we always need a reference point, right?
Yeah.
Like saying the car is parked 500 meters from the grocery store. The store is the reference.
Exactly. You need that fixed point for the distance to mean anything.
And you see this on highways, like with kilometer stones. Those markers along the road in H44 is mentioned. They tell you the distance from a specific starting point, helps you navigate, know where you are.
A very practical application of reference points, definitely.
Okay, so we've kind of nailed down how we quantify the static world, the length of things. But the world isn't static, is it? Not at all. Everything's moving. And here's where it gets, well, really interesting. Motion. The definition is the change in position of an object with respect to time and its surroundings. It's happening constantly all around us.
And it's so much more important than we might first think. I mean, track your steps on your watch. That's motion. Understanding how cars move, designing safer vehicles, exploring planets, it all comes back to understanding motion. And historically, figures like Galileo, Newton, they formalized this understanding, built the foundations with their laws and math.
Right. So our sources break down different types of motion based on the path the object takes. Let's run through them. First up, linear or rectilinear motion. That's just moving in a straight line. Pretty simple. Think of a bike going down a perfectly straight road or an apple falling straight down from a tree.
Straightforward, yes. Then you have curvilinear or random motion. This is movement along a curved path or even an irregular one, like a train going around a bend. Or think about a butterfly flitting around. Definitely not a straight line.
No. Okay, next, circular motion. This is moving around a fixed point in a circle. And the key thing here, the axis of rotation is outside the object itself, like the moon orbiting the Earth.
That distinction is crucial, because then you have rotational motion. Here, the object spins around an axis inside itself. Think of a fan's blade spinning or car tires rotating.
Got it. Axis inside for rotational, outside for circular, and finally, oscillatory motion. This is that back and forth movement around a central point, like a clock pendulum swinging or a kid on a swing set.
Exactly. Repetitive back and forth.
Yeah.
The sources also briefly mention things like vibratory motion, like a guitar string buzzing.
Yeah.
And periodic motion, which repeats regularly, like a clock ticking or planets orbiting. That's distinct from non-periodic motion, like clouds drifting randomly or leaves falling unpredictably.
Okay, lots of ways things can move.
And here's a kind of mind-bending fact flash from the source material. Even when you think you're perfectly still, you're actually moving incredibly fast.
Oh, yeah. How so?
Well, you're on Earth, right? So you're rotating with it. At the equator, that's about 670 kilometers per hour. Mm-hmm. And the whole Earth is orbiting the sun at something like 107,000 kilometers per hour.
Wow. Okay. Puts my walk to the shops in perspective.
Doesn't it? And even something simple, like a sneeze. A typical sneeze travels around 160 kilometers per hour.
Seriously, a sneeze.
Yeah.
Okay, that's surprisingly fast. It really shows how much motion is happening, things we don't even notice. But speaking of motion, there are some common misconceptions we should probably clear up. Like that old question, do heavier objects actually fall faster than lighter ones?
Yes, the classic. The correction is no, not really. In a vacuum where there's no air resistance, everything falls at the same rate because of gravity. Mass doesn't matter for the acceleration rate.
Right. Air resistance is the complicating factor in everyday life.
Exactly. And another one, does motion always need a constant force pushing it?
You'd think so, maybe.
But Newton's first law says no. An object in motion will just stay in motion at a constant speed and direction unless some other force acts on it, like friction or air resistance. Think of a hockey puck lighting on ice or satellites orbiting Earth. They don't need constant rockets firing once they're up there.
Okay, that makes sense. Inertia, right. So these concepts aren't just theory. They apply everywhere. The case studies in the sources show this. Like a 100-meter race that's pretty clear linear motion. The runners go straight.
Yep. But then look at a discus throw. It's more complex. The athlete spins around first. That's rotational motion. Then they release the discus, and it flies through the air in a curve that's curvilinear motion.
Nice example. Two types right there. And even the model roller coaster example they mention. It brings measurement and motion together. You'd need a flexible measuring tape to figure out the track length with all its curves. And you'd see linear motion, the car going down a straight slope, and circular motion when it goes through a loop.
It's a great way to see all these different ideas in action in one system. So yeah, to kind of wrap things up, the measurement of length, understanding motion. These are truly fundamental. They form the basis, really, of how we understand the physical world. They let us quantify distances, dimensions with accuracy, and analyze how things behave over time. And these aren't just, you know, classroom topics. They're essential day-to-day and absolutely critical in advanced science, building bridges, launching satellites. It all relies on this.
All right. So what's the big takeaway for you listening? It means you've finally got a deeper grasp now on how we measure our world and how we describe all its amazing movement, from the tiniest things right up to planets dancing in space. You're basically better equipped now to see and understand the science happening all around you. So maybe the final thought is this. Keep an eye out for these principles, length and motion. They're not just concepts. They are literally the language science uses to measure and understand the universe. It's how we keep pushing the boundaries of what we can figure out, what we can build. How will you start noticing these ideas showing up in your own day, maybe in a way you didn't before?